This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll talk with Capital Watcher C.B. Fragonston about recent developments, as in yesterday, the Louisiana House coming to a consensus on the budget. Now, whether this will fly remains to be seen, but the House, including Democrats and Republicans, has decided on a new budget approach that the Democrats and Republicans hope will pass muster with Governor Bobby Jindal. We'll discuss it with C.B. Fragonston. Also on the show, Donna Douglas. Remember Ellie Mae? From 1962 to 1971, there was no show on television more watched than the Beverly Hillbillies. And one of the biggest stars in the galaxy was Donna Douglas, pride of Pride, Louisiana. She's back home in Baton Rouge, the author of a cookbook, and we'll talk with her about this and more. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. You may also reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with C.B. Fragonston, the Capital Watcher and former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee, and it's been a week full of buzz at the Capitol, and it seems as that each day has brought a new development. Good morning, C.B.
Good morning, Jim. I hope y'all are weathering the thunderstorms in Baton Rouge.
A little treacherous, but so far so good. But thank you for your consideration. Now, there's a storm of sorts at the Capitol, a budget storm. What in the world's going on?
Well, it started out as a reform effort by the fiscal hawks to remove the one-time money from the state budget and replace it with recurring revenues, because they've long fought against using one-time money in the state budget. For obvious reasons, it just kicks the can down the road. They came up with a plan to put some recurring revenues in the budget by way of removing some of the tax exemptions and lowering some of the tax exemptions to create a steady stream of new revenue and to supplant the one-time revenue, and then use the one-time revenue in the budget for things that was intended, like capital outlay for paying down the unfunded accrued liability and things like that. That was getting such negative reaction from the public, the business community, as well as the membership of the House, that they went to a different plan just the other day, which has come up with another plan to supposedly address the problem, but really has offered a political solution for what's a fiscal problem. And so now we have a plan to replace one-time money in the budget with sometime money, as I call it. And it's just, I think the fiscal hawks lost sight of the purpose of what they were intending to do, and that was to remove one-time funding for recurring expenses. And that was a good goal. But unfortunately, they lost sight of it in the process of gathering the number of votes. And so they came up with a plan based not on principle, but on political expediency. And that's where we are today. And they have the legislature will be taking up these revenue measures as well as the budget today. And if it passes, to me, it won't make the situation one bit better. Just changing a dollar with one serial number on it with a different dollar, that's still not a secure revenue stream. And even worse, that while focusing solely on this $500 million in non-recurring revenue that's currently in the proposed budget, the legislature has lost sight of the $1.2 billion shortfall that's built into the budget. So it's a shame that they haven't fixed anything, that we still have one-time money in the budget. And we still haven't addressed the elephant in the room, which is over $1 billion in revenue shortfall.
Well, yesterday, House Republicans and Democrats were on the Capitol steps celebrating. Are you saying this is a premature celebration?
I am, and talking with legislators and others around the Capitol, they feel the same way. I was told that one of the legislators who did not go out on the Capitol steps said, you know, we need to wait till we do something before we celebrate. And I think that was a good thing. So they were celebrating a political coming together of various factions, the House Republicans, Democrats, and the Black Caucus. And, you know, that's a good thing that they all sit down together, but they haven't fixed the problem.
I've read in some quarters that you're advising the fiscal hawks. Is that correct?
Well, not on this. I have, they have asked me for my advice off and on for the last year or so. And they certainly didn't include me in on this, and I've sent out my own note to them, as well as all the House members, that I thought that this was a bad idea. So, you know, when you come up with a bad idea, people are happy to give you credit for it. But when you come up with a good idea that everybody else likes, they don't tell you. So I'm not sure why my name was brought up in there, but it wasn't by me.
Okay. What about the tax amnesty plan? This is a creative way to fill a budget hole, about $200 million. Is this a valid way to do it?
No, that's the crux of the problem. That's over half the money that was going under this plan to use to get rid of the one-time money. This is another scheme by any other name. And it's going to have bad repercussions, not good. First of all, it's just substituting revenues that, by a legal definition, that have a revenue source of more than 2 years, which is a three-year amnesty plan. But it's still money that won't be there after 3 years, and it may not be there at all, according to the Legislative Fiscal Office. They say it's very speculative. And I agree. And then the unintended consequence of this tax amnesty plan, which will supposedly bring in $200 million a year, but the Legislative Fiscal Office has their doubts about it. But even if it does, it means that we have gotten rid of the backlog of debt owed to the state, and we have just replaced it with a very speculative decision. And if everybody pays their taxes, then in the future, we just did this 4 years ago, that there won't be, people will not pay their taxes until the next amnesty. That's a chronic problem, not only in Louisiana, but everywhere. Some states have tax amnesty programs every 10 years, and a lot of people just wait around till the 10th year to pay their taxes. So instead of encouraging revenues to come into the state, it discourages them. And that's another. It's just bad fiscal policy. It may be legal, and that's why 3 years rather than, you say, why not just 1 year? Because that would then automatically say that it's one-time revenue under the statute. But, you know, whether it meets the statutory requirements or not, I mean, I think everybody knows that just common sense says that collecting past due revenues is a one-time thing.
Well, do you think, whether you like it or not, this plan will fly? Will it be embraced by the House and Senate and signed by the governor?
Jim, if I knew the answer to that, mm-hmm. I would not be talking to you, I'd be playing the stock market. Now, seriously, I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't heard any reaction from the Senate to this particular plan. It's hard to say. But the net result is going to be, I believe, that the governor is going to get whatever he wants in this plan, and then it's up to the House and Senate to decide whether to accept it, or mostly the House. And the you know, let's say traditionally what will happen is the House bill will be taken over to the Senate Finance Committee. It will pass the House, and the package will pass. But generally, once it gets to the Senate, the governor puts the budget exactly the way he wants it, and the same thing with the tax measures. And then they send it back to the House, and the House decides whether to go along with it or not. And generally they don't, and they put it in a conference committee made up of three House members and three senators. And then they produce a report that usually is exactly what the governor wants. And then that's the showdown time in the House to determine whether they have the votes to approve the governor's plan or not approve it and maybe have to come back in a special session. And that's where all the drama will occur, and it'll probably be the last day of the session.
Did have a question from a listener about the Internet sales tax that's included on this. Now, this would be a new tax. Governor Jindal says he can't abide that, so it would seem that he would have opposition to this.
No, it's not a new tax, Jim. Amendment did yesterday was to, and I know there were media reports to the contrary, and they're just wrong. What the amendment did was merely to encourage the Department of Revenue to crack down on Internet sales. Now, how they go about doing that, I don't know. The tax has always been there. It's based on the fact that out-of-state sales, or sales over the Internet, the seller is not required to collect the tax on the behalf of the state of Louisiana, let's say if the seller's in California. It's because of some federal law jurisprudence years and years ago that the burden is on the consumer to pay their Internet taxes. So if you buy a shirt from California and it comes in here at $10.95, it will not have any taxes on it. But you're required under the law to, say, in Baton Rouge, if the tax is 9%, take that 9% and keep a running total of that. And when you pay your state income taxes the following year, there's a line on there where you are to include the sales tax owed to the state on that Internet service.
That's what John McGinnis reports. He says the plan calls for collecting $20 million through a tax form on state income tax returns, which would ask taxpayers to send in $50 if they reached a certain level of Internet purchases. Is this kind of a scout's honor type thing?
it's like double scout's honor. It's telling the revenue department to please make everybody be honorable. And there's no way for the revenue department really to enforce it unless they're going to start checking people's computers. Theoretically, they could come to my house and check my computer. If they find that I made an Internet purchase, then they could charge me the sales tax on it.
That's how they got Al Capone and David Duke. Maybe C.B. Forgotston is next.
It could be.
Well, C.B., you're the warm-up act today for Donna Douglas, who's in studio.
Well,
she'll be
joining
us in a few moments. I'm sure you've been a fan like most
of us. I have always been a fan of hers. She's from the Beverly Hillbilly days.
There you go. So we look forward to hearing from Donna in a few moments, and always good to visit with you, C.B. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate
all
it.
Right.
Take care. And I did want to note that one of the fine gentlemen in this community, Oscar Richard, man who was born on December 7th, 1921, served our country with distinction in World War II. He was a POW. He wrote about his wartime experience in Kriege, a fantastic book. He died a few days ago, and tonight at Rabenhorse downtown, 5 to 7, there will be visitation. Tomorrow the services are at St. Aloysius at 1 p.m. Oscar Richard was a longtime public relations director at Louisiana State University, and he is a member of the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame. So we will remember Oscar Richard, those of us who knew him well and were in a coffee group with him, with great satisfaction, and a man who provided wisdom and class and talent to this community for 91 years. Born in Sunshine in 1921, Oscar Richard is gone at 91. We'll return with the fabulous Donna Douglas after this 90-second timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Donna Douglas is in studio. She is the pride of Pride, Louisiana, and she is back on her home turf. Has been in the Baton Rouge area for a few years now, and of course she went off to California at a very young age, made it big as Ellie Mae. And good morning to you, the beautiful, vivacious Donna Douglas.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Wonderful to be here.
Well, it's good to have you back. Now, you're now a writer. Donna's book is Southern Favorites with a Taste of Hollywood, and she will be at Barnes & Noble City Place tomorrow at 2 o'clock, 2 to 3, with her book. So you'll get a chance, if you wish, to meet Donna Douglas. Have a book about food. Why was this project on the front burner at this time in your career?
Well, I don't know. I just thought, well, maybe it was the time. But I worked with a lady, friend of mine, and so we got it all together and come out with this little cookbook. But it's a little different than most cookbooks because it has anecdotes and like all kind of little illustration, lots of pictures and lots of recipes and all those things. It's just a very informative little book.
Well, you obviously have great affinity for food, as most people do who grow up in this area, as you did. And Donna Douglas is one who went around the world and back. Is there any place like Louisiana when it comes to cooking and cuisine?
I don't think so, no.
No?
No. It's like some people say to me, I'd come back here. You know, they said, a lot of people don't come back home. You know, I said, well, that this was always home to me. You know, California, I was there and everything, but it was like Louisiana was home.
You loaded up the truck and went to Beverly, right? Hills, that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Swimming pools, movie stars. Why did you go? Why did you leave Louisiana?
Well, you know, it's kind of amazing how your life goes. I guess it's a little different than most people because so many people train all their lives to be successful and to do, you know, certain crafts or certain talents. But in my case, I didn't have, I wasn't aware of any talent. It wasn't, I had never done any singing, dancing, acting, never planned to be an actress. So it's amazing how your life works out, and then you, all of a sudden, the farthest north I'd been was Shreveport, Louisiana, and I tell my folks one day, I said, Mom, Dad, I think I'll go to New York. Maybe I can get a job up there.
You went to New York first?
Yes, I went to New York first, and I said, maybe I can get a job up there, and I wasn't thinking about being an actress or anything like that, and so got on a plane, got as far as New Orleans, and the man from the airline said, if you change your reservation, you could get in an hour earlier. Well, I thought it was fantastic, you know. And so instead of landing in New York City where I was going, I landed in Newark, New Jersey. I didn't know they had two airports in New York. We just have one at home. So you make your decisions in life from the information you have on the inside. So I always encourage young people, get information.
Was there a big break? Was there a catalyst that caused all this good fortune to happen to you early in life?
Well, when I got there, I just met these people. I didn't know anybody up there. I didn't have any reason for, you know, any reason, a legitimate reason for going. I just thought maybe I could get a job. And so it was kind of amazing how I made a commitment. I think that was the key. I made a commitment when I got to New York. Because I was shy and awkward, and really, I'd never been before people a lot or anything like that. And so, I was raised a tomboy, so, you know, as a kid. But when I got to New York, I didn't have talent or anything that I was aware of. And so, I made a commitment to God, though. I made a commitment. That commitment was that I believe with all my heart that if I do the best that I could do, that God would take care of me. I just believe that. So I wasn't afraid about being up there. I had no concept of New York or anything. But I made that commitment also. If mom and dad had trusted me enough mm-hmm. to let me go, I was going to be worthy of their trust and put those little seeds in my heart. And that's where I started off. And then it's just when I made that commitment, just everything in the world started coming my way. You know, I had men want to keep me in penthouse right. apartments, give me money, make me successful, just do all these presents and all this. They had yachts, the whole thing.
Men were doing this for you?
They wanted to. They were willing. They was willing, but I'd made that commitment to God. And that's the only way I wasn't afraid about being up there by myself and everything. And so as I let all those shortcuts go, mm-hmm. well, then it was like, if you walk, you talk, kind of that kind of thing. And so, as I didn't have much to go on, what could I do? I said I hadn't had any singing, dancing, acting, nothing like that. Wasn't thinking of being an actress or anything. And but I could smile,
yeah.
you know. And so it was like I got. I could take hold up the billboard on Steve Allen's show. I could take a bundle of letters out to Perry Como on his show and that kind of thing. And so that's how I started out. Don't ever ask me to say anything, though. I couldn't have talked.
Did you realize how beautiful you were?
Oh, no. I never planned to be an actor. I never planned anything about show business. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a ball player, a softball pitcher. That was what I did all in the beginning. Well, That was I never really thought about being an actress or really, you know, as I said, as far as appearance, you know, looking nice and things like that. I'd entered a couple of contests at home, but not because I thought I wanted to, because I did it for a little friend of mine, the lady that had a florist, Miss Hodges, and she just right. begged me to enter a contest, and that's why I was only in a contest in Baton Rouge.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk to the amazing Donna Douglas, who's still doing it after a few years. It's been a few since the Beverly Hillbillies. Years ago, I had the privilege of interviewing you and Max Baer together. I think you were both on the phone, but Max revealed that he actually went out with you before the Beverly Hillbillies, and that your first date and last date was to a church.
I take you.
Yeah, he said, this is really unusual. He said it was at some Catholic church on Wilshire Boulevard. Do you recall that?
Blessed Sacrament Church, it was, absolutely. Oh, you know, speaking of Max, I was just back in Los Angeles earlier yeah. this year, and we did a memorabilia show, had a huge memorabilia show.
Yeah.
And so I got to see Max, and we worked together. So that was an experience. He hadn't changed.
No.
Still going miles a minute, you know.
Now, there's an example of a guy who had to be a great actor, because Max is a smart guy, very smart man. But Jethro, not so much.
Paul said he was a few bricks shy of a load.
What a cast, though. Irene Ryan, Buddy Ebsen, Max Baer, and Donna Douglas. It was a fantastic group, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. We love work. You know, we worked together, and everybody was so grateful to be working. You know, I mean, Buddy, of course, had done vaudeville. He had just done everything. I didn't realize how much he had done until his memorial service, and they did like a little movie or of all the many things that he had done. It was remarkable. I mean, he just, from vaudeville on, he did so many things, worked with so many people, you know.
297-5633 if you'd like to engage the wonderful Donna Douglas, who says she never really left Louisiana. You can go somewhere else, but Louisiana stays with you, right?
That's
and
right.
You were one of the true Louisiana legends. So Donna Douglas is one of a kind, and we're privileged to have her as one of our own, and it's been quite a voyage. When did you know the Beverly Hillbillies was going to be this overwhelming success?
Well, I went from, you know, just a series of events, just amazing things. Things just happen in my life. And so from New York, then I had met a movie producer there, very briefly through some people, and so he had told me He said, if you want to go to Hollywood and do a screen test, because about 2 weeks before I decided to be an actress. And so he told me, he said, if you want to go and do a screen test, come to California. Because actually it was Hal Wallace. He was from Los Angeles Paramount Studio.
Yeah. Big guy in the business.
Uh-huh.
Linda in River Oaks. Linda, you're on the air with Donna Douglas.
Hi, Donna. This is Linda.
Hello. Hi.
My mother used to talk about how just charismatic you were and how beautiful you were, and you turned every head that passed you by. She worked out at state police in the county, and she said that you were just gorgeous, and there was a picture of you in the state police uniforms that they had all the women wear, you know, the brown skirts and the brown shoes and stuff, and you were lined up with Mary Prather and Vervin Hood, and my mother was Lola Wall, and she told us how everybody just were, you know, you looked the same way then as you did when you were on television.
Oh, my goodness.
You hear that a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. 297-5633. Chris on Mohican. Chris, good morning. You're on the air with Donna Douglas.
Good morning.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm so excited to talk to you. Many years ago, people have asked me, if you could meet five people in the world and have them sit down at a table for a conversation, who would it be? And you were one of those people.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
Well, growing up, I had a sad childhood, and the comedy that I got from Beverly Hillbillies and the cast and characters on the show really had an impact on me to be able to learn to laugh at some of the silly things and just be able to take the pressure off of being a kid. And it was a great show to do that. And I appreciate you, and I appreciate the show for doing that.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
Those kinds of stories have to touch you.
Yeah, you appreciate them so much. Mm-hmm. You know, people have been, I mean, even today, you know, I meet people and they tell me how much they love the Beverly Hillbillies. They said because, and especially parents, you know, they'll come up to me in airports and they'll say, we never had to worry what the content of your show was. You know, we could always depend on, if we put our kids in a room, we knew what the content would be, we knew what they would be watching. But, of course, today you can't do that. You know.
Well, those first 5 years, the show was so popular, you could take any one of the episodes and it would be the most watched television show in America for this year, because you only had three networks, and most of the people who were watching in those days were watching the Beverly Hillbillies in its time slot.
Yeah.
So I bet you couldn't go anywhere in the United States, if not the world, and people didn't say, there's Ellie Mae.
Oh, yeah. I went to Japan. They sent me. I went on a trip. They sent me the studio, and was getting an award there, and for the show, and Jaja Uma. It was just amazing. The people they were hanging, and I got to the airport. People were just everywhere. Just amazing, you know.
Well. It still happens, though. You haven't changed a whole lot.
You know, it's when you go places, it's amazing how they they said, you know, when I did a book signing once before, and they said, you know, you drew as much as Oliver North.
Did you get typecast? Was it hard to get roles after the Hillbillies?
That never concerned me, because I always thought, well, surely they can see beyond, you know, they will know. But I didn't mind it, because I loved doing Ellie. It was like a slice out of my life. And I don't know. I never thought about the typecasting or anything like that. It's almost just, as I said, I loved doing the show and everything. And it was always so good. And today it's been like a little door opener for me, that I speak a lot in churches and youth groups, ladies groups, work with young people, and got my books going. You know, I had a children's book out before my cookbook, and it just seems like, I always say my life kind of goes like a fan, you know,
right.
Just goes, all these wonderful things just seem to keep happening.
This deep religious faith that you had it when you were Ellie Mae in Hollywood, that's a town that's quite often regarded as one that's not so devout. How did your faith affect you in any positive way, or people reacting to you in unpositive ways while you were acting at the grand level you were?
Well, it was like when I went there, I wanted to do family things. All my thing always was to do positive things like that. And I was very fortunate when I first went there. I met through the course of a short period of time, I met three ladies. The first lady was going, when I met her, she was going to help me with my Southern act, get rid of my Southern accent.
You wouldn't want to do
and
that.
She got me into singing a little bit. And then I met another lady, and she became like a little prayer partner. You know, but all of these women, then she introduced me to the third lady. And she taught me right attitude, right motive, right thought, right deed, not how I could manipulate people to get what I wanted, but how God could use my life. So that was that. It wasn't a matter of having to say so much to people, or you wasn't preaching to them or anything like that. But it was just a matter, you know, you just let the love and the caring and everything come out through the TV. And so that was more or less how I really expressed, you know, that. And I've had people come in and tell me, you know, there was something different. You know, I could tell something different about you.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Dorothy, you're on the air with Donna Douglas.
Hey, Donna. It's good to talk to you. I'm one of your Facebook friends.
Thank you.
Anyway, I wanted to thank you so much because you made a pretty profound impression on my life. My mom wouldn't let me watch the Beverly Hillbillies because of your costume. And the funny thing was, it was too provocative for her. And I used to sneak watching the Beverly Hillbillies. When she wasn't home, my babysitter would let us watch you.
Well, you know, you're saying about that, about my jeans. Yeah, my jeans did fit. I think so. Mm-hmm. But interesting thing about the Beverly Hillbillies. Beverly Hillbillies was sort of the American dream. And the amazing thing is that when I wore a bathing suit, I could show no cleavage. I could show no belly button, a tummy button. And my bathing suit had to be cut straight across the legs, you know. In other words, they couldn't be cut up high or anything. So, and the Hillbillies, we were always respected our parents and critters. We love people. So it was a positive. If you really got to understand the show and get beyond maybe the little costume or the humor, we had wonderful values, and we respected people and everything.
Did you get along with Irene Ryan?
Yeah, oh Granny, yeah, she was a sweet lady.
She died young though.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, she did. She must have been what, in the early 70s.
If that, yeah, she.
Yes, yeah, somewhere. But she had from the Hillbillies. She had gone into Pippin in New York, and she was playing Charlemagne's.
And she passed away. And we'll talk a bit more with Donna Douglas and have a few other surprises when we return after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And we're visiting with none other than Ellie Mae. Donna Douglas, she was on the Beverly Hillbillies for almost a decade. The show, when it was canceled, was a top 10, 15 show. What happened with CBS? They canceled a bunch of shows at that time, if I remember right, including Green Acres.
Right. I think they canceled about 10 shows. The Hillbillies was still on, and of course, it was like they never could make their mind up. They would go back and forth. Like most shows had a final show and knew that they were going off the air. We never did know we were going off the air because they kept saying we were going to be back in September and everything, but they couldn't decide. So we never did. They never did turn us off, and we've run every day since.
Were you bitter about that?
No. We sure hope to stay on and keep going. That was 9 years. We'd been on 9 years by this time.
How was Uncle Jet?
Oh, I love That was my Paul. He was so much like my real daddy. And he had wonderful, he was wonderful principals. He was quite a fella. He really was.
Mm-hmm.
I had more of my scenes with him. Jethro worked more with Granny. But many of my little scenes were with him as my Paul.
Is that house in Beverly Hills, this is a question from Sophie, is that house still around, the one where the hillbillies gathered?
Well, finally the people that bought it, what they've done now, because they used to, people would go up to, because you know where we'd pull down, where we would go down the hill, you know, and ring the little bell to call to let them know who was out there. The people said they'd like to drove them crazy going up there and asking for Granny and Ellie Mae and everything like that. So now they've completely reversed. They've opened the...
What street was that?
It was on Bel Air Road, near Stratovecchi. But now they moved it over to they moved it over to Neems Road. And that's sort of they've totally put trees and everything up to hide the entrance.
Well, when you... when you pass away, and I think it'll be many years before that happens, you know you're going to be eulogized throughout the world for being on the Beverly Hillbillies. That's not a bad legacy, is it?
Oh, no. I love doing that show. It was just a joy to do, and certainly I love the people, and they've certainly been good to me.
Well, tomorrow you can meet the remarkable Donna Douglas, who is from right here in the Baton Rouge area, born in Pride, and she'll be there with Southern Favorites with a Taste of Hollywood. Donna Douglas and her cookbook, and she is a delightful person who has a joyful aura about her. Thank you, and good to visit with you as always. 2 to 3 tomorrow at City Place, Barnes & Noble, Donna Douglas.
Sure has been nice visiting with y'all. Now, y'all be sure and stay tuned now. You hear?
Now we're joined by, thank you, Yule Smith. He is the executive director of the Louisiana Seafood and Marketing Board. Good morning to you, Yule Smith.
Good morning, man. I don't know if I want to follow that act. That's
you do have a tough act to follow, and I want to cover a little bit of ground with you. First of all, what's going on regarding House Bill 167? This affects what you do and the board that you're in charge of.
Well, that bill, as a seafood board, you know, all these years we've been parked under the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. That bill will essentially move us to the Lieutenant Governor's office, and the industry is reviewing that bill to see where they stand on that. Our board's looking at it, and then we'll see what's going to happen with it next week. But, you know, we do a lot with the Lieutenant Governor's office. His office has been a great partner of ours over the years, but the industry needs to take a look at it and see if they like that idea or not.
It passed the House overwhelmingly, didn't it?
Well, it went out of the committee, the Senate and Government Committee last week, and so now it's going to go to the floor. We'll probably read it on Monday, and it'll go to the floor Tuesday of the Senate Tuesday or Wednesday. Yes, sir.
Okay. Has it passed the House?
No, it started in the Senate, on the Senate side. That's correct.
All right. Well, Yule Smith, you also are involved in an industry that is one of the most compelling ones in our state. How has it changed since the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe?
Well, you know, what we've learned from every crisis, dealing with the crisis is with imports, really, when you start looking at the amount of imports that came in early 2000s, and then Katrina was our first major, huge crisis. And then we learn a lot from those things. The industry, every crisis creates opportunities and creates many challenges. And with the oil spill, our brand has been pushed around the world. Now, it was beat up really badly, you know. So now we're still in the process of rebuilding the brand. But we've gotten a lot of attention across the United States through the cook-offs we've done. We've built relationships with chefs, not just in Louisiana, but across the entire United States. And we learned the importance of our chefs following Katrina because they helped us tell people our seafood was fine following Katrina when they dewatered the city of New Orleans. And it took us 2 years to overcome any perception concerns from that. But with the oil spill, we knew it would take longer because it was on TV for so long and the negative press on it was so horrific for us. But the chefs came to us wanting to help, and that's the good news. And we've been working with chefs and developing relationships with chefs across the United States. So our brand is out there, and we're you know, as far as getting the brand out there, we're not getting those negative comments like we once were, that's for sure.
You got some additional funding as a result of the catastrophe. You've been on the job 12 years. How has that helped the cause?
Well, thank goodness we've got the funding because, the brand, at the height of the oil spill, there was a 90% concern rate for consuming Gulf seafood or Louisiana seafood. And that was right in the middle of the oil spill. We are at probably between just above 20% concern rate around the United States. And really, from the industry itself, we don't hear any questions anymore because people understand the amount of testing that has happened over the past 3 years since this spill started. So that's very good. It's taken that kind of money to get the word out with the promotions and the marketing, whether it's the advertisements you see in state, whether billboards or TV. What people don't see, what we do out of state, which is the trade shows and the events and the PR that we generate outside the state. So the money has been very, very helpful. And we would not be where we are today without those funds, that's for sure.
We still
have a long way to go, too. We still, we're not out of the weeds by a long shot, and that's why those funds are so important to helping us rebuild our industry.
$30 million, isn't it?
That's correct. And we've gone through about half of it. And, we're going to need the other half to make sure we're back to where we were prior to the oil spill.
Well, you also have the annual seafood cook-off taking place in a few days later this month. It's part of the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. 10 chefs, is that right, throughout the state will be competing, and they're going for the title of King or Queen of Louisiana Seafood. What happens on May the 24th?
Actually, the event is going to be on May 25th. It's going to be at the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience starts on the 24th. Our event actually is on their food and wine, their grand tastings on 24th and 25th. On the 25th is when we'll be there, that Saturday at 2 o'clock, and it's open to the public. They can go to New Orleans Wine, N-O-W-F-E, New Orleans Wine and Food Experience's website, alfie.org or .com, to go to buy tickets. Now, that event has been a marquee event for us. We have the chefs competing from across the state, and whoever wins becomes our ambassador for the next year. That person also will compete at the Great American Seafood Cook-Off in August, which is a national event that we produce as well, and that's on PBS nationwide. So whoever wins our event, their careers, we always put a lot of PR and press behind that winner, and it accelerates their career and their restaurant, by multiple leaps. And we help, and they also become our spokesperson. They help us promote seafood across the U.S.
Well, we wish you well. You've got a big job, and you've survived a few challenges in 12 years. What's been the biggest one?
The biggest one, I think, by far was the oil spill. And then, because at the height of it, we didn't even know, when we were in the middle of the oil spill, a month and a half into it, we were scratching our heads, we could even have an industry. And but we're coming back strong. We got to make sure the resources there. But we're coming back strong with the brand, and the people are trusting our brand across the United States now. But to rebuild that is a very large task, and it's not just Louisiana rebuilding the brand. It's our sister states, all of us working together. That's how we get out of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yule Smith and many others representing the seafood industry will be in New Orleans in a few days, the 6th annual Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off taking place. His event is the 25th. Food and Wine Experience starts the 24th. And the event that you discussed earlier, Saturday, 2 weeks from tomorrow at 2 p.m., and where do you convene?
It'll be at the Memorial Convention Center, Hall J., And then they can get tickets at Nowfe, N-O-W-F-E.com. And it's a great event. They can taste the different wines and all the different foods. And, of course, we'll have our cook-off is inside of their event. It's the Louisiana Seafood Cook-Off. And we'll see who the next king or queen will be for Louisiana. Right now we got Keith and Neely French from Lola in Covington won this past year, and they've done a terrific job for us promoting our seafood. And the time has come for the next king or queen to be announced. So we'll see who wins.
Well, thank you, Yule Smith. Good to visit with you as always.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Bye bye.
And we're joined in studio as we round out the week by some folks representing the Kids Orchestra here in Baton Rouge. The spring concert is tomorrow, 4 p.m., and with us, let's start with Gwen Jones. Gwen is getting the microphone from her partner, Jody Haney. Gwen is the executive director. Jody, who we'll hear from in a few moments, is director of advancement and development. And the Kids Orchestra, as noted, is performing tomorrow. Tell us about your fine group.
We are an after-school music education program meeting twice a week. This is our second year of existence. We have an outreach to children all over Baton Rouge. Presently, we are working with children from 9 different schools, bringing kids from EBR, private, and charter schools together. We focus children of kindergarten through 5th grade. We are currently teaching violin, viola, cello, clarinet, flute, percussion, and music foundations.
Well, how many are in the orchestra?
Currently 72.
And how do you become a member of the Kids Orchestra?
Your parents sign you up.
Well, you have a waiting list, or do you have to pick and choose?
You know what we have? Our schools calling us and saying, let us come. In terms of waiting lists for students, no. Our doors are open to any child that wants to be a member of Kids Orchestra.
So if you get more than 72, you might have 73 or 74
then
members?
Then we hire more teachers, and we buy more snacks, and we get more instruments.
Well, it's a group of kids, generally the age group. What are we talking about?
5 to 10 years old.
5 to 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And they're playing these magnificent instruments. How do you get them to the point where they're suitable for performing as they will tomorrow?
We have very fine teachers. Mm-hmm. We practice. We encourage confidence. We are teaching music in addition to the skills to play the instruments. And they've been practicing very hard. I think people will be surprised at how beautifully they play tomorrow.
All right. And Jody Haney is the Director of Advancement and Development. How did the orchestra start?
Well, the orchestra was started by, we had a founder, her name is Nanette Noland, and she came up with the idea of forming a kids orchestra to help unite children of all races, cultures, backgrounds of Baton Rouge. And she thought, what a great way to do it, but through a kids orchestra. And what we do is we actually go into select schools, and we partner schools with private and public schools together. So, for instance, we're at St. James Episcopal Day School, and we provide transportation for children from Dufrock School to come over to St. James. And we also have Sacred Heart there as well. And these children come twice a week. And they get there. We provide a healthy snack for them. Then we do homework with them. And our teachers actually serve as tutors before they actually go into group lessons with them. And then we do bucket band, and everybody mm-hmm. plays in bucket band. And then the children disperse to their different orchestral lessons.
So this concert tomorrow is a culmination of a lot of work with these young people.
Exactly, because one thing is that we're at 3 different sites, and so our curriculum has to be aligned across all the schools, so the children have to be learning all exactly the same thing. And then once a month we get together for all orchestra rehearsals, and all 75 children come together, and we practice together on a Sunday afternoon.
Okay. And it's black kids and white kids playing together, right?
It's everyone, all of our children together of Baton Rouge. That's the most important.
All right. So
thing.
Tomorrow you'll gather at 4 o'clock.
Yes, sir.
Where?
We're going to be at Christian Life Fellowship on Quell Avenue. That's 2087 Quell Drive. And we'll be doing a nice concert. We're even going to have our teachers performing as well.
And you invite our listening audience to come if they wish.
Absolutely.
That's tomorrow, 4 o'clock, Christian Life, Quail Avenue.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jody Hane and Gwen Jones, involved in a great endeavor in our community, the Kids Orchestra. Have a great weekend, everybody, and happy Mother's Day to everybody it applies to. Until Monday, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.